Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
One moment, sir.
Yes, I do know the drill. You knew.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hilary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss the first episode of the sixth and final season of Netflix's The Crown. The debut episode is called Persona Non Grata.
Tu vas voir? No, I'm not welcome there anymore. Very much persona non grata.
Later on, Vanity Fair's royal editor Katie Nicholl is going to be stopping by to help us separate fact from fiction. Very exciting.
But first, let's do a quick recap. It's Camilla's 50th birthday. Prince Charles is planning a party, and the Queen delivers a royal snub.
Your attendance not only as my mother, but symbolically as Queen, would be transformative for Camilla. She will never be fully embraced by the public until she has your approval.
But how can I possibly give my approval when I don't approve?
Princess Diana takes William and Harry to the south of France to play video games on a yacht, which is something we've all done. Mohammed Al-Fayed orders his son Dodi to ditch his fiancée to woo the princess.
Now, very sadly, I have some work to do, but I can leave you in Dodi's hand. He is much more fun than me. Whatever you wish, it's his command.
Meanwhile, media coverage of Diana in her bathing suit overshadows Camilla's milestone birthday.
What's the use of a few warm headlines when Camilla can be eclipsed by Diana at the drop of a hat? I don't want partial, qualified victory. This is war. Only total victory will do.
So at the top of this inaugural episode of our Crown recap, I have to ask you guys a really important question. The show is in its sixth season. Did we ever think in the previous five seasons watching the show that we would hear a Smash Mouth song on The Crown?
Wow.
Got a Smash Mouth song following a Chumbawamba. A Chumbawamba tub-thumping
They're
drop.
Really hitting us with the mid-late 90s.
They are. Oh, yeah. They watched Jumanji. Wait, I think that's episode two. Is that a spoiler?
I think it is.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry,
but yeah. we're going to have a whole segment where we can talk about our favorite 90s nostalgia moments. But yes, I will say it's a bracing moment. You know what? It humanizes Diana further because she was a woman with bad taste who loved bad pop culture.
A cool mom with bad taste. Yeah. That is 100% Diana. I loved it. I was like, wait, was this song alive then? Because the 90s, I was like, wait, is this the early 2000s? Like, I didn't know, but yeah.
It was.
You thought that Smash Mouth was the early 2000s?
Well, for me, Smash Mouth is Shrek. It's 2004. It's...
Shrek came out in the year 2000.
Oh, did it? Well, okay.
2001.
We need to get Peter Morgan to write a show about when Shrek came out.
Yeah,
but obviously, you know, silly pop culture references aside, we are very cognizant of the fact that this is headed toward good because the season opens with, you know, a guy walking his dog in Paris, a car goes zoom by, and then crash. And we obviously, it's Diana and Dodi and other people in that car. Is it hard watching it? No, do you think it's kind of cruel to set it up this way, or is there's no other way to do it, I guess?
I think they do. They know that the audience knows where this is going. Like,
right.
the entire arc of Diana is a tragic arc defined by the way that her life ends. And I think that the show knows that throughout. It's not going to play coy. It's going to acknowledge that from the start and then kind of do the flashback thing. I don't know if a flash forward is totally necessary since we do all know how the story ends, but I can understand dramatically why they would choose to acknowledge it and then kind of pull back and say, like, but we'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like a crown simp, but I feel like that was maybe, like, the most humane way they could do it, just sort of get that out of the way. We don't see it happening.
Right.
We're not, at least in the first episode, we're not with her in the car. We're not there. And yet we acknowledge this is how it ended. Now let's roll back the tape and see where she was 8 weeks before.
So I liked the honking horn kind of fading into the theme song.
It was artfully done. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we're not going to see the accident any more than that. I don't think anyone wants to see, any of that stuff. But I think one thing about the foreshadowing and then it goes back in time is, like, it's only 8 weeks. I really had forgotten. I mean, I was a teenager. I wasn't really paying attention. But, like, for some reason in my head, like, Diana and Dodie had been together for years.
6 years in my head.
And it was wild. It was not even 2 months.
Yeah.
That was really crazy.
Which is really interesting. And I think that this episode does a really good job of setting the groundwork for that relationship in a really kind of intriguing way. You know, I mean, first we should say that, you know, like, Diana goes to Tony Blair and Tony Blair's wife calls William an alien.
Can we talk a little bit about William? Yeah. Not to go back to the last season, but big age jump. I watched season five right into season six and I was like, that is not
well,
the same
boy. It's like when Claire Foy suddenly becomes Olivia Colman, you're like, oh, that's
okay.
I feel like in 5 years you don't age that much, but take
1 week. It's supposed to be like 1 week in between season five to season
six. He's got like soap opera baby syndrome.
Yeah, but so that really did throw me for a loop. But that was nice to see Diana and playing with Tony Blair's kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think this episode does a good job of showing like this version of Diana, and maybe it's the truth that like she was really devoted to those kids and really good with those kids, and people liked her and people supported her, except for the Queen, who is like, you can't be half in something, And Diana's now learning, because Tony Blair is like, basically, she wants to do good. She's so famous. She's so beloved. Can't we put her to good use? Mm-hmm. And the Queen is like, no.
Yeah.
which is where, I don't know, we were talking about it in our sort of little teaser episode, but like, is Peter Morgan going to be critical of the Queen? Because here is where, I mean, he did make the movie The Queen with Helen Mirren.
Which is more critical than the series The Crown, I would say.
Exactly. And so I'm curious to see, starting with this first display of QE2 being super stubborn, is that going to persist as the Diana stuff unfolds? Because, like, by certain estimations, like, the Queen was really bad about all of this.
Oh, yeah.
And but that's not really the portraiture that this show has given of Elizabeth in the past, exactly.
I mean, it has portrayed her as, having a big, maybe blind spot's not the right phrase, but like a big mental block when it comes to squaring like the personal happiness of her loved ones and this kind of sort of imagined like sense of what her duty is. Like, I don't think that there is a rule book, but it also kind of feels like she just sort of has decided that there are things, I mean, according to her characterization on the show, obviously, I don't know the real woman, but that there are things that the Queen mustn't do and there are things that she must. And even in the year 1997, you just cannot embrace a divorced woman, even if she is the mother of your grandchildren. Like,
yeah, I would definitely say that the Crown has never painted Elizabeth to be mother of the year to her actual children, although she is mother to the country. And whether that is more important than being mother to her literal children, I think it does a pretty fair job. I mean, her refusing to go to Camilla's birthday party was so...
Just say who's saying, like, straight out, like, how can I say that I approve when I really
don't approve. At this point.
And after, Charles pointing out, like, they've been separate. He's been separated from Diana for 5 years. Yeah.
They've been divorced for a year. Yeah. I think separated five more on top of that.
Yeah.
So it's been almost half a decade,
it's
over
just
half
wild.
A decade.
It's been half Harry's life, basically. Yeah.
It's just wild that even then she cannot, like, find a way. And, of course, we know the end of the story, which is that Charles and Camilla are going to have to wait even longer to be together officially because in the wake of Diana's death.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
I will say the show really has always been like, Charles and Camilla are end game. Their love is real.
OTP.
OTP.
Yeah,
with Emerald Fennell. Yeah. And I think knowing that, it's so hard to take, what we know in the 20 years since or so, 30 years since, out of watching this show where it's like, that actually Charles and Camilla, like, are really in, like, that was the love of his life. So the Queen especially after what she did to Margaret and not allowing her sister mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. get married because of a divorce and not learning from that. I think that's pretty critical of the queen. And I think we're sort of, you know, landing more team die. Not that there are sides, not that we're putting two strong women against each other, but.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the project of the show, among other things, has been to show Elizabeth go from human princess and then as she hardens into an institution. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, certain things like compassion for your children kind of have to go by the wayside when you are the institution. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting in this episode to see Margaret, who has very many reasons to resent her sister and kind of like want her sister to be alienated from people, is like, hey, maybe like ease up on Charles a little bit. Like, he's happy. He's going to be the king someday. We want a happy king.
Yeah, that shot of Leslie Manville just kind of quietly enjoying the party and like looking at them. It really hits you.
Yeah, so like the Margaret arc on this show has been great. I really hope that she's kind of fallen a little bit by the wayside because it's just like she was basically smoking and drinking. That's what she was doing.
For 50 years.
You know, apparently she would go to the opera, but she would show up late so they would have to hold the opera for her. And then she would show up and everyone would have to stand and acknowledge her in the box and whatever.
What a queen.
I hope we get some really. Margaret fun this season. But I also am wondering how you guys feel about, I mean, obviously the Diana stuff is what everyone is tuning in for. Mm. How much Charles, Camilla, do you think the show can sustain and keep and hold people's interest? Like, is it interesting to you guys?
Well, I think our silence sort of speaks volumes. Yeah. I'm not interested in it. And I do think, especially from the sort of spin doctor of it all in terms of, you know, how do you make Charles and Camilla legitimate? I do think that is more interesting than their...
The strategizing
is more interesting than their actual relationship to me.
Yeah. Well, the non-Diana thread or the non, like, specifically Diana thread in this episode that I really responded to and thought was really interesting and well done was Dodi. Because I think that he's sort of a mystery to even people who know a ton about Diana because, as you said, their relationship was really so short in real life. And so I admire the show taking time to flesh him out as a character. He isn't just sort of a guy who shows up and it's a story about her. It's really a story about the two of them. And yeah, I don't know. There are ways in which he's as tragic of a figure as she is. He's the victim of these insane expectations. He has this dictatorial father who rules his entire life. He can't get married without his father's, you know, and he just really is so nakedly yearning for Muhammad's approval that he, you know, will just torpedo his entire engagement to go after this thing that may or may not exist just because he just wants to be like daddy's boy. Yeah. And I don't know. I think that there's like a real poignancy to his story too.
It's really, I think that is so true. Poor Kelly. Really. Man. Didn't know she existed before the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that last season when they did the episode where they did like Muhammad Al-Fayed's backstory, it was a bit like, why? Because isn't Dodi the one that she was with? But now I get it.
Yeah.
Well, because if you don't know his whole deal, then you won't understand why it's such a big deal for him that Dodi get with Diana.
Exactly.
It's so, and I will go there because this is actually very important because race is very important in The Crown and we're seeing this even today. But like Muhammad's obsession with being an Anglophile, being British, it's so
being an Englishman.
Being an Englishman and being respected by the Queen and being respected by these people, it's so tied to whiteness and race and wanting to be a part of this culture that has excluded him that he will never actually be a part of. And seeing that pressure, him having these fantasies and these delusions of, you know, becoming an Englishman and seeing how that kind of destroys and ultimately ruins and takes his son's life away is really devastating and is an interesting storyline to watch sort of play out. Because we see the car crash and we see the only reason that Dodi's going after Diana is because his dad is like, I will not love you unless you do this.
Like, I don't love you now.
I don't love you, and I will only love you if you bag Diana.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, basically.
It's really wild.
Are you saying that colonialism has, like, lingering effects?
Let's not be crazy, Richard.
In the British Empire.
That empire, please.
I can't imagine. I think that it is really great that the show is taking these pains to humanize Dodi because I think, you know, sometimes you watch like these true stories about a tragic death or a murder or something and someone feels sort of like narrative collateral. Like it's just like they're like, oh, yeah, and then they were there. Ron Goldman was there, you know. And it's like I think that it's important to get the full scope of what this meant, not just to like people who are following the royal family, but there was a whole other family that was, in some senses, royal itself, that was deeply, deeply affected by what we see happening.
And not just deeply affected by it, but also, like, a catalyst for why the crash happened in the first place. Just so, like... And I don't know, the craziest part about Mohammed's entire plan is that it kind of worked.
Yeah.
Like...
Oh, yeah.
He managed to hook that fish.
Yeah, but what does that say? And that brings me back to Diana. That, like, what does that say about the space that she was in? Because, you know, she's sort of reeling from this divorce. She's sort of seems like the most vulnerable little bird that is anyone who's just there would be able to forge a connection that way. At least at this point, I found myself, and props to tall Diana Elizabeth Debicki, who I was like, wow, she's probably like 6 feet and she's doing really good. She's 6'3".
She's really tall.
That is so tall. Yeah. Like,
she's incredibly tall.
Incredibly tall.
Yeah. And she's Jacob Elordi tall.
It's really, but I think something really fantastic about her performance, and I think a part of the reason why season five I lost a little bit of interest is because we sort of got away from Diana. Like, she was sort of depressed Diana, and then she was sort of like not in it as much, and then it was...
I think Elizabeth Debicki is getting more interesting material this season.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And we're seeing at least on the boat, on the yacht, like, she's definitely still delicate and still this sort of, like, bruised bird. But she's a little flirty. The light sort of comes back to her eyes a little bit.
And also, I think that the show does a good job, and especially in the Emma Corrin season and in this season, I think you really see the ways in which Diana is, you know, this wounded and vulnerable person, but she's also canny, and she can play the press. She knows how to... manipulate things for her own side as well. Like when she, you know, takes the boat out to the paparazzi.
Didn't know you were so interested in fashion, Nick.
Did you choose it deliberately?
Deliberately, huh?
Well, you must be aware that today's Mrs. Parker Bowles' birthday and a big party is being thrown for her this evening by the Prince of Wales.
You know, I'm having trouble hearing you. I'll tell you what, you leave me and my boys alone, please. And you're all going to get a big surprise with the next thing I do.
Oh, aye, what's that? What do you mean a big surprise?
It's like, hey, boys, like,
this
I'm going to give
you want.
I'm going to give you what you want. Now, can you leave us alone? And like, I mean, you know, there is the tragedy of her thinking that she can play them. And in the end, she can't. But there is a way in which she does know what she's doing. And the show, you know, shows that she has agency, that she is able to swing the narrative, and that she's doing this specifically because it's Camille's birthday is kind of a delicious, petty...
Well, yeah, I think that showing a little bit that Diana does kind of still like to needle that thing.
That headline.
She could have gone to talk to the paparazzi in shorts and a t-shirt, and she didn't, because she's strategic, you know.
Yeah.
I think Debicki's performance has really only gotten better, you know, now that she's had some time in the role. The head cops and the sort of like the sort
looking
of
under her hair.
Yeah, looking under the hair.
Yeah.
That sort of like the roundness of the voice. Like, it just, it's uncanny, but also not an impersonation, which I think is a really hard line to walk. And I don't know that everyone on the show has always done this cough. Gillian Anderson is Margaret Thatcher. A performance I like, but like that was a lot.
You know? That was a lot.
But no, she's a thrill to watch. What do you guys think about, I mean, I guess, Chris, you're both younger than me, but like, Hillary, you probably remember better than Chris does, but like, for about 2 years, Prince William was like on everybody's wall, like pictures of him, like
Tiger Beat, he
was like a big freaking deal.
I did not know that. And
he was a heartthrob, and it was weird for me personally. This is
Prince
a bit of a
William,
brag.
Not Prince Charles. Okay, I was confused.
Wow, we're not that old.
No, I'm talking about Prince Philip.
Okay, Prince William was a heartthrob.
Prince Henry VIII. William was a heartthrob, which was always weird for me personally because my brother, as a teenager, looked exactly like Prince William.
Wow. Really?
I'm going to find a picture and I'm going
to
show you guys. You're
going
to believe me.
I hope you fared better as he grew up.
Yes, his hair is much thicker now.
Is it weird seeing him? I don't know. Part of me, when I was thinking about this possibility seasons ago, like, eventually they're going to get to that stuff. And I was kind of like, maybe they should just not have William and Harry ever on screen. But now obviously they have to, and I don't know, it works for me. Like, I think the actors they chose are good, but like, I guess we're gonna have to see a lot more of them, right? What do we think about this depiction thus far in this episode?
I am always struck, again, I obviously know Prince William and Prince Harry, actually do, I promise, and I didn't realize, though, like, how different in age they were. Like, I didn't realize that, okay, Prince William was sort of a teenager, right? Like, he was at Eton, he's like, you know, kind of like becoming a man, and Prince Harry is literally like a babe. I mean, he's like a
he's 12.
He's like, well, yeah, but he the seems so yeah. a young 12.
Yes.
The way that it's being played is he's like a little boy.
He's mommy's little hugger, and like yeah. he's, you know.
And Wombat yeah. is like yeah. becoming and has thoughts about Dodie and mm-hmm. doesn't really yeah. thinks he's corny. And I think that is interesting. I think they've been keeping them sort of at bay because they're going to have to push them forward as the season progresses. And I'm leaning in to the portrayals thus far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a delicate thing. You don't want to focus too much on them, I think, because, you know, they don't have a ton to do in this part of the story, mm-hmm. really. You know, they're collateral damage.
They're going to walk sadly behind a funeral procession. I mean, in those famous photos.
Exactly. Like, but it is important, I think, to meet them and start to get a sense of their personalities, considering what role those two characters are going to take in the end. Is it starting to feel kind of gross to call these people characters when most of them are still alive and on the public stage? And
yeah, I think that's a very interesting and a fair point, and we should be cognizant of that.
We should maybe note also, you know, what their camps have said about, or at least what William's camp has said about the Crown in the lead up to this season. He had a quote in the press that said, "I think William will not watch the show, but he will be sickened by it."
Yeah,
which
is like. I mean, that's, you know, that's your prerogative.
That is 100%. That's totally fair.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the show opening with the way it does, like, you know, this car chased by these paparazzi. And, you know, it's like, well, here we are part of that same rabid interest and chasing them into the dark. And, oh, well, like, I don't know. They're making the show.
Here we go again. Yeah.
So we're watching it. But, yeah, I would say as a premiere episode for the final season that has to kind of set a lot of table, you know, I think they did a good job. I feel... perhaps guiltily, perhaps not, compelled by what's to come, though I kind of just wish we could hold off the accident for as long as possible. You know, like, I don't want to stay on that yacht for a while, but I don't know how likely that is.
Yeah.
I mean, Elizabeth Debicki being sat on a boat is...
It's pretty good.
It's really
I will watch hours of that, yes.
I mean, so have you seen Tenet? Because she does that in that.
Yeah, that scene with Dodie and Diana on the boat, and she's sitting at the piano, and you can see her reflection in the piano, and she plays the piano, is so... totally encapsulated all of that. And I do think showed like a genuine connection. I was like, wait, maybe this could be true love. Maybe something real can come from this absolute parent trap.
Yeah, which is also a tragedy. Like if Muhammad had just like took a chill pill and waited a few months or a couple years or something.
Yeah.
Maybe something.
Things could have been different.
Could have blossomed.
But making us watch the delicate formation of this relationship and root for it makes it sting all the more what's going to happen. So goddamn you, Peter Morgan. I guess he knows what he's doing.
He did it again.
Yeah. Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, more on The Crown with our royal editor, Katie Nichol.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Here at Vanity Fair, we are spoiled for choice when it comes to royals correspondence.
So over the next few weeks, as we watch The Crown, we're going to phone our friends, get a couple of different royal experts to help separate fact from fiction.
Yes. Today, we have Vanity Fair's royal editor and co-host of Vanity Fair's Dynasty podcast, which you should all listen to, Katie Nichol. Hello, Katie, and thanks for coming on Still Watching.
Well, hello, and it's wonderful to be back doing another podcast with Vanity Fair. Thank you.
Actually, before we get into that, I'm sort of curious. I mean, you are the royal expert of royal experts. What is your feeling about The Crown generally as a depiction of the royals, its accuracy, its entertainment value, all of the, how do you feel about the show?
Well, I think on entertainment value, it's pretty unbeatable. The casting is incredible. And I actually was lucky enough to go onto the set for one of the earlier series and to see Buckingham Palace recreated and Downing Street. And, you know, clearly this was an expensive production and you can see that reflected in the costumes and the sets, but it really was mind-blowing to be on it. And, you know, I've done this job writing about the royals for over 2 decades now. And, you know, I would like to think I know the subject very well. And I still find myself sort of watching this and having to remind myself that I'm watching a drama. That's not to say that everything I see is factually accurate, because this is a drama. And I think it's really important that we remember that. But it's a drama about characters that are so familiar and about events that are very much etched in our memories, both, you know, distant and not so distant. And it's brought to life in a very real way. So if I have to watch it and sometimes remind myself I'm watching a drama, then anyone that's sort of not a royal expert, perhaps just a royal fan, might just need to be reminded that, you know, you are watching drama. And of course, there's been so much talk about whether it should carry a disclaimer, pointing that out, that it is a real, you know, it's based on a real story, but this is a fictitious script with fictitious characters. And my sense is, particularly when they delve into some of the more personal issues, and this feels so personal because it's so close to modern history. It's so close to all of the events that, yes, they happened in the 90s, but we still remember them so clearly. Then I do wonder if a disclaimer, just out of sensitivity and responsibility, for me, I think it probably would have been the right thing to add to the series, but it's probably the only addition I would make.
As you said, you've been covering the royals for 20 years. This first episode of The Crown, we see sort of a different side of Diana, and Diana sort of hanging with Dodi al-Fayed on that massive super yacht. So if I'm not mistaken, you've interviewed Camilla al-Fayed, Dodi's sister, who was on the yacht with Diana and Dodi. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I've got a copy of the book right here, because this was my very first book that I wrote. It's called William and Harry Behind the Palace Walls. And I remember very clearly sitting down with Camilla Fayed and interviewing her and talking to her. It was the first time she'd ever spoken about that summer of 1997.
She's a teenager. She's around the same age as William and Harry, a little older than them.
Yeah, so she's perhaps just a year or so older than William at the time. She's got her older sister Jasmine there and their younger brother Omar. And she says to me, you know, that summer we all became a team. I was 11 at the time and my sister was 15. We used to hang out with William and Harry all the time at the palace, and we were so excited about spending the summer together. And it was wonderful. We adored each other and we did everything together. And I think when I watched the first episode and I saw that camaraderie between Camilla and her brothers and sisters and William and Harry, and it was, you know, it was lovely to see. I mean, William and Harry loved going away on holiday with their mum. It was always very different to holidays with Dad, which would be in the sort of cool castles of Balmoral with usually a pretty drizzly summer over here in the UK. And so to be going over to Saint-Tropez would have been very exciting. And I think all of that excitement is captured, and also a bit of apprehension. And you see that particularly with William and Harry, who are quite uncomfortable about the presence of all the paparazzi who surround the yacht, both the Jonacol yacht and Fayed's villa, when they realise that Diana and the boys are guests there. And I think the episode captures very well that intensity of what they were constantly up against, not just Diana, but increasingly the boys as well. And for actually much of that episode, William's sort of shut inside playing computer games. And I write in my book how much he and Harry were into computer games. I say here, Harry was the self-proclaimed king of Sonic the Hedgehog, and his mother could barely keep him away from the screen. So there you go. It's nice to be proven right through The Crown, if nothing else.
Wow. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, the William and Harry's apprehension around the press is kind of something that comes up for the first time in this episode, which is understandable. But we do see that Diana has a more ambivalent relationship maybe with the press. We watch her kind of go up to them on a boat, you know, tell them that she's going to do a quid pro quo. If they'll leave her alone, then she'll pose for them. Did that ring true to you?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting because they mock up the front page of the Mirror, and there's that picture of Diana sort of posing, you know, like a swimwear model, and she didn't in fact quite go that far, but certainly she went up to the paparazzi ostensibly to plead with them to leave William and Harry alone. But, you know, Diana was a great manipulator of the press as well, and what that episode captures is that the same time this holiday is taking place, back at home at Highgrove, it's Camilla Parker Bowles, as she then was, now, of course, our current queen. It was her 50th birthday. And you've got Charles preparing this very important milestone birthday party and giving a speech and briefing his aides, Mark Boland at the time, who was in charge of Project Camilla Parker Bowles. That was the project to make Camilla more acceptable to the general public, because she was still very much the reviled mistress. And it's very interesting because you've got Charles briefing his aide saying, I want positive coverage of Camilla in the papers. At the same time, the papers are still absolutely obsessed with everything Diana is doing. So, of course, when she jets over in the yacht's tender in a fabulous swimsuit to go and ask the press to back off, they get a fabulous set of pictures, which knocks Camilla Parker Bowles and Prince Charles off the front pages. So that whole Prince Charles actually calls it a war in the tabloids. He calls it that in that first episode. Was a war. It was the War of the Waleses that was played out in the tabloids. And that, again, is captured, I think, quite accurately in this episode.
It feels like she made a splash in part because of that amazing swimsuit, the leopard swimsuit. It's such a stunning swimsuit. And I'd love to know how much of a splash that made as like a fashion moment when that was captured in the newspapers.
Well, I mean, Diana had the most sensational figure. I mean, her body was incredible. She was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, whether it was on a magazine or a newspaper, you know, that issue would sell. And she had a great flair, I think, for fashion and for style. She was bold with her colours and her prints. She was experimental. And, you know, she was perfectly confident wearing a pretty high-cut, sexy leopard print swimsuit. And I think for those of us old enough to remember that period of the 90s, I mean, I can see that crystal clear today as it was back in 1997, that image of her and all of the tabloids. And I think it's become, well, probably one of the most iconic parts of her wardrobe, because those pictures just went around the world because she looked so stunning. And here she was being entertained by the Fayeds, very controversial, very Diana, looking sizzling hot in a leopard print swimsuit.
What are you kind of looking for? Looking forward seems like the wrong way to phrase, and since we know what's going to happen as these episodes go on, but kind of what are you looking for, I guess, as you watch the rest of this first batch of episodes?
Well, it sounds mawkish, doesn't it, to say, you know, you want to see how the car crash is portrayed. And in fact, the series opens with a Frenchman walking his dog who comes out for a late night walk and witnesses that crash in the tunnel. So you're very aware from the very moment that the credits start rolling that this is where, you know, this is where this story is all going. This is going to be a milestone moment in this series. I think sensitivity is really the word that springs to mind for me, because for William and Harry, not that I necessarily think they will watch it. I know Harry has watched previous series of The Crown. Whether or not he's going to watch this, we'll have to wait and see if he says anything on the subject. I think probably the Prince of Wales will be less inclined to watch it, because it's going to be a very painful reminder of the past. And I suspect that while there might have been an interest in some of the more historic series of The Crown, this is just a bit too close to the bone. So what am I looking forward to? So what am I looking forward to? Well, personally, I'm looking forward to seeing how William and Kate's courtship is portrayed in this series, because I wrote a book very much about their relationship and their courtship at St. Andrews. It's the making of a royal romance. I believe it was used actually for some of the script writing. So I shall be watching very, very closely and seeing just how much might have been lifted from my book.
Yeah, we have to have you back once we see that episode.
I will come back and let you know what I think might have been extrapolated from my book. But jokes aside, and of course they do use these books as matters of research. I think how they portray that courtship, how it developed in that bubble of St. Andrews is going to be interesting to see. And, you know, watching the princes grow up, which is basically what I've done for most of my career, it's going to be a bit of a trip down memory lane.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we are celebrating the 90s, baby.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world.
the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There is 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we go, we're going to do a final segment dedicated to the 90s when this season is set. Well, at least this first part of the season. This show is a time capsule. Was there a moment pop culture-y that jumped out for you guys? I mean, obviously, I already mentioned Smash Mouth. I mean, Hillary, you seem to be a fan of the Jumanji reference.
God, I loved Jumanji. I also spent the mid-90s watching Jumanji on a loop. I never got to watch it outside on a yacht.
Really? South of France?
Oh, you must.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh, yeah. Pennsylvania, that's a common place to watch a movie. But yes,
you
it
have
is.
Three rivers to choose from.
Oh, wow.
And Kristen, what was yours?
Okay, mine, there was one line and then one outfit that I thought were so 90s. One, hearing the line, the ever-reliable Daily Mail, really just got, really took me out. I don't know if that was ever true, but I was like, that's a funny way to talk about the Daily Mail. And then I loved Diana's cheetah print suit. Mm. I thought that was so 90s. And then I went and looked up the actual photos of her wearing that suit, because that's the interesting thing, too, about the show is that, like, a lot of these outfits, you can, like, just, like, look at the paparazzi shots and see, like, the version, the real version compared to the crown version. I just was like, oh, that's so Diana in a cheetah print bathing suit.
No, like, my mom, like, Diana was her number one style icon. Like, she had, I'm pretty sure she had a bathing suit that looked just like that, and I bet she got it because of Diana.
Yeah, and you don't see that anymore.
I don't blame her. That she looks fabulous. I enjoy Elizabeth Debicki in the Diana voice saying Jumanji. I texted some friends and I said, I have news for you. Elizabeth Debicki says Jumanji in the new season of The Crown. I also enjoyed her saying Street Fighter, William's favorite video game. I also thought it was funny in the little conversation I put on the closed captions when Dodie is down talking to William, like kind of bonding, like man to man, and then Diana's dropping ice cubes on them. They're talking about Bond. So she's like, my brother and I play GoldenEye. We like that movie. And then Dodie's like, well, I'm working on the new one. And you hear William say, who's playing the Bond girl in that one? And so I was doing the math and it's like, I think it's either Michelle Yeoh, because I think that Tomorrow Never Dies was 97, or It's World is Not Enough, which would mean Denise Richards playing Dr. Christmas Jones.
No, that's what Denise Richards was invoked.
So I wonder if young Prince William would have been excited to see Dr. Christmas Jones, a.k.a.
Man,
Denise Richards.
I bet he was. Did you have a go-to Street Fighter character, either of you?
I'm gay, so Chun-Li, always, every single time. Well, that does it for this week's episode of Still Watching. If you have any questions, concerns, anything about The Crown or the real life story behind The Crown,
Smash Mouth song,
your favorite Smash Mouth. I mean,
90s
how can you pick one, really? can you please send us your Smash Mouth song rankings to our email address, which is stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can find me for the time being on what was once Twitter. At Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. That's also my Instagram.
And you can find me on both X and Instagram at Christress.
You can find me at Hillabuster with 2 R's, except that you can't follow me on Instagram. I'm private, sorry.
Sorry, that's just for us. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. Next up in your feed right now, episode 2 of The Crown. See you there.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.